What does it mean to experience a deadly epidemic?
In recent months, people have struggled with this question, but it's not a new question. Welcome to Experiencing Epidemics podcast. We are Gaspar Jakovac,
Jorge Diaz Ceballos,
and Ian Hathaway, and we want to explore this question as historians by delving into personal narratives drawn from the long history of people's encounters with epidemics.
We do so thanks to the contributions of scholars based at the European University Institute and beyond.
This project is brought to you as part of the COVID-19 Knowledge Hub of the European University Institute. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of Experiencing Epidemics podcast, coming to you from the wonderful hills on the outskirts of Florence, where some seven centuries ago, Boccaccio himself set the stage for his Decameron.
We are delighted to be here and to see this project finally come together.
I am Ian Hathaway, a historian of the early modern Mediterranean.
And I'm Gaspar Jakovac, a cultural and theatre historian of early modern England. We are part of Experiencing Epidemics editorial team. And over the next 10 or so episodes of this podcast, we will investigate how people experienced epidemics before the rise of germ theory in the late 19th century.
To do so, we ask our contributors to transport us into the past through readings of selected primary sources. Through these narratives, we will explore specific experiences of and attitudes towards epidemics. We hope that this process may help us better understand our current crisis and confront the feelings of loss and displacement that many of us have been grappling with. I have the honor of welcoming our first contributor. Today, we are keeping things in the house with our very own Gaspar Jakovac, who has generously agreed to provide material for this pilot episode. Gaspar chose to talk about a rather unusual source, or set of sources, I should say, an anonymous plague poem written in response to the 1636 plague outbreak in Newcastle, and a slightly earlier poem that contests the use of bills of mortality as a meaningful response to plague epidemics. The 1636 outbreak of plague was far from the worst in the history of England. But for Newcastle, the northeastern port city, it was devastating. Local preacher Robert Jennison claimed that the plague arrived in North Shields, a town on the mouth of the River Tyne, in October 1635. There, the disease lay dormant until the next spring, which was exceptionally warm. In May 1636, the infection started spreading like wildfire, soon reaching Newcastle. In less than a year, it took the lives of more than 5,500 people. It wiped out almost half of the entire population of the city. Even though the plague ravaged mercilessly, radically transforming the patterns of everyday life, all sense of community and social obligation was not lost.
25-year-old Ralph Taylor didn't flee Newcastle when the epidemic erupted. He remained on the front lines. However, Ralph's profession was not, as we might assume, that of a doctor or a nurse. He was instead a scrivener. He worked day in, day out, writing down the wills of plague victims.
On August 8, 1636, for example, Ralph climbed the city walls near the river together with a couple of witnesses so that he could listen to Thomas Holmes, a plague-struck citizen, who dictated his last will from a loft room. Ralph clearly specialized in social-distanced will-taking. A true testament to human resourcefulness in times of crisis, Ralph also demonstrated incredible courage and resilience in maintaining a semblance of social normality. He did not abandon his neighbors. He stayed put, and he did his job.
Last spring, I spent a month working in Durham Cathedral Library. For those of you not familiar with England, Durham is a small city in the northeast, just south of Newcastle. It is home to a magnificent Norman cathedral. I warmly recommend a visit, COVID-19 permitting, of course. In the library, I came across an interesting manuscript, a collection of 26 religious poems of local provenance, dating from the late 1630s. We don't know who the author of the poems is, but it might have been a local clergyman, perhaps a prebendary of Durham Cathedral, keen on music and church ceremony, for the poems were meant to be set to music. Most of the lyrics focus on the mysteries of Christ's life or particular feast days. But one piece of the lot is unusual. It's a plague poem called In the Great Plague Time in Newcastle. Understandably, it piqued my curiosity. Bold as we are, how we undaunted stand, whilst our revenging God his shafts lets fly above our heads, killing on every hand, living scarce let to bury those that die. Yet we, fond sinful elves, so fearless of ourselves as if we were exempt. A lethargy benumbs our hearts and ears, the dying sighs and groans, the living's cries and moans, which small or slight appears, serves but for talk and story and the news. Once told and heard, is of no other use. But we swear on, drink on, add sin to sin, doing our best to outface our God, thinking, by being worse than we have been, poor fools, to fright him from his rod. A far more dangerous plague be levied than theirs, no less infectious, yet more pestilent. For he who sees his maker's wrath, yet dares go on in sin, fester than ere he went. He frustrates the good God of his intent, who always strikes for our amendment, but missing of his aim, and finding man still worse and worse, having done all he can, not able or to do or suffer more, hear men and tremble, has hell fire in store.
Thank you, Gaspar, for sharing this poem with us and for the dramatic reading. That was very vivid. Now, can you tell us something about your first impression of this text?
To me, the poem sounds almost like a plague sermon set to verse and music. Otherwise, it's a rather conventional item of early modern plague writing. But the way this conventional message is articulated is nevertheless intriguing. The lyrics are powerful, musical, well-crafted. The sighs and groans and cries and moans reminded me of tears and sighs and groans in John Dowland's famous song, Flow My Tears. Some of you may know it because Sting recorded it a few years ago, so you don't have to be an early music enthusiast to know it.
Oh, I actually had no idea. So that's a wonderful piece of information for me. So when listening to your reading, I was struck by the fact that the poem contains few specific details. No place names, no Ralph Taylors, or other such elements. Only the poem's title points to the fact that Newcastle was the site of the plague outbreak. How do you explain this?
That's a very good point. We need to remember that the author was not primarily interested in particularities of the epidemic, but in spiritual and moral lessons that can be extracted from it. Such rhetorical dynamics is entirely conventional for plague narratives of the period, especially those that relied on religious discourse.
And what do you mean by religious discourse?
I'm referring to a sort of field of reference through which plague could be interpreted and understood.
And were there other such discourses through which early modern Europeans understood plague?
Yeah, several. Historian Colin Jones analyzed early modern French plague tracts and suggested that all of them adhere to one or more of the three basic plague discourses. The first one is a medical discourse employed to secure a healthy body. The second one is religious, which cares for spiritual well-being of individuals. And then finally, a political one, whose aims are communal integrity and prosperity. Now, these three discourses do not always appear separate, but freely mingle, accommodate, oppose, and complement each other.
All right, so I see then how this specific poem would really fit squarely into the religious discourse model.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of quarantining and airing our clothes, for example, we ought to repent and turn away from sin. For the author of the poem, the physical suffering of individuals are a clear sign of the community's spiritual decay. So the correct interpretation of the plague is therefore supposed to make us realize that the physical illness, which only kills bodies, is a far milder calamity than the spiritual one, the plague of sin. Now, by stressing the supernatural aspects of the plague, the poem comes into conflict with the more secularized medical and political discourses. Indeed, according to some who took a strictly religious perspective on plague, the measures advised by doctors and magistrates did not always encourage ideal responses to the catastrophe. For example, whilst criticizing people's indifference towards the suffering of others, our poet states, "A lethargy benumbs our hearts and ears, for the suffering and death of people serve only for talk and story and the news."
So, are you saying that our poet is critical of those for whom the suffering of others is a spectacle of sorts, a piece of exciting, of dramatic, certainly, but of fleeting news?
Yeah, precisely.
Okay. But what kind of news are we talking about exactly? And why would our poet associate with the more secular interpretations of the plague?
Well, the most important items of news in plague-ridden communities of the 17th century England were the bills of mortality. These were printed broadsides. Think of them as one sheet of a large newspaper. Published by the local authorities on a weekly basis. They contained a breakdown of local plague deaths in individual city parishes. We mostly associate them with London, but they must have existed in Newcastle as well.
And what was the purpose of these bills?
Well, historians think that the bills of mortality were an important tool in regulating the perception of an epidemic. Aaron Sullivan, for example, suggested that they offered their readers a way of imagining and combating disease, allowing them a degree of control over an otherwise devastating force.
Oh, I mean, okay, wow. So, I mean, the similarities to our daily COVID-19 reports of infection rates and even death rates is really striking.
Yeah.
How would early modern English people use the kind of information that they got from the bills of mortality?
Not unlike we do today. So, based on the number and location of plague deaths, The people could decide whether to avoid particular parts of the city or to flee it completely, if they could afford to leave the city, of course. When weekly plague deaths in London reached 30, for example, public playhouses were closed and so forth. The deaths of fellow neighbors, therefore, served as potentially life-saving abstractions printed on broadsides, which all could buy for a penny. Instead of provoking spiritual reflection on our sinful nature, the bills of mortality entrenched people's fear of death. They abstracted plague victims into plain numbers, whose practical usefulness quickly waned as the epidemic progressed. In the Newcastle Plague poem, the connection between bills of mortality and religiously irresponsible behavior is sort of tentative. But a poem of another contemporary writer, Francis Quarles, published in 1632, is much more explicit about this connection. The piece is called On the Site of a Plague Bill. "5,000 in a week in one poor city, because it was thy pleasure, 'twas no pity. Why should thou pity us, just God, when we could never find a time to pity thee? Thou never strikes without a reason why, nor often, then, we easily cast our eye upon the punishment, but blind to the sin that far transcends the judgment it calls in. Oh, if the weekly bills of our transgression could but appear, and make as deep impression in our sad hearts, to make our hearts but know as great a sorrow as our plague bills do, no doubt, no doubt, but heaven's avenging hand would turn a stranger to our prosperous land. Oh, if that weekly catalogue of sin could with our city bills be brought but in, and be compared, we'd think our bills not high, but rather wonder there are men to die."
Well, thank you again for the wonderful reading. And I guess I can really see the tension emerging in this text between the different plague discourses that you were talking about a few moments ago.
Exactly. Quarles fantasizes about a catalogue of sin, a list published alongside the weekly bills of mortality, where all our transgressions would appear enumerated. So if plague bills put us in fear of our earthly lives, the bill of sin would not only shift our worries towards the afterlife, but also make clear to us how deserving we are of the plague. We'd think our bills not high, but rather wonder there are men to die. I think the author of the Newcastle poem would be in a complete agreement with Quarles. A rather grim conclusion, I'm afraid, but an interesting insight into how people interpreted and experienced the plague in early 17th century England.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for the analysis. Now, as we head towards the end of our show, would you like to leave our listeners with one final thought before we wrap up?
Yeah, well, I think there are definitely a lot of parallels, but also differences in our experiences of COVID-19 and the 1636 Newcastle plague outbreak. Understanding the virus as divine punishment or urging people to repent are mostly missing from our contemporary COVID briefings, right?
Yeah, definitely.
but that doesn't mean that successors to early modern religious discourses are completely extinct and gone from our societies.
Of course, yeah. Well, food for thought, thank you. And thank you, Gashpad, for, in general, sharing these fascinating sources with us. I really look forward to having more discussions of this kind with future guests.
Thank you. Yes, me too.
Thank you once again to Gashpad. Now, we have almost reached the end of our time together. And small disclaimer, we are unfortunately no longer recording from the wonderful studio at the EUI, so please bear with the varying audio quality of this final segment. Now I would like to use these last few minutes to introduce the third component of our editorial team, Jorge Díaz Ceballos. How are you doing today, Jorge?
I'm fine, Ian, thank you.
And could you tell us something about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I'm a historian of the early modern Spanish Empire.
Great, thank you. So you now had the chance to listen to the recording that I did with Gashpad. Do you have any comments or thoughts you would like to add to our discussion?
Sure, the piece was amazing. I was really surprised by how similarly people faced a pandemic 400 years ago, not just in terms of hygienic measures, although also that, but especially on the efforts of people to find reasons beyond what it's obvious, often denying scientific knowledge or medical evidences. I was thinking as I was listening about the anti-vaccine movements or believers in some sort of conspiracy theories around the virus, and even people who deny the very existence of the virus itself. So I thought that it was really a tension between what people see and what people want to believe or decide to believe.
Yeah, there certainly is a commonality in the fact that people now and then find multiple ways to give meaning to the dramatic events that they experience. Thank you for bringing that up. And thank you so much to all those who have made this project and this first episode possible. The funding bodies at the EUI for supporting us, Gashpad Jakovac, of course, Sebastian Majstorovic, who is our sound technician and a researcher at the EUI. Thank you also to Miha Jakovac for helping us put together the Experiencing Epidemics webpage, which, if you haven't already, you can find over at experiencing-epidemics.org. And finally, thank you to Anton Serdechny, a wonderful scholar of early modern Europe, who we will have on the show in just a few episodes, and who, it turns out, is also an accomplished musician. He has composed and performed all the wonderful music on this show, which would not have been the same without him.
We hope you have enjoyed the first episode of Experiencing Epidemics podcast. And if you like what you've heard, please tune in again for our second episode, where we take a closer look at a very special Renaissance plague treatise. Thanks for listening.